science enthusiasts. My name is Jason Zakowski. I'm your host. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, but you probably know our dogs, Bunsen and Beaker, from social media. They're the Twitter science dogs. This show takes what's best from their account, the curiosity and fun found there, and swirls it into podcast form. Every week, we take a deep dive into a timely science article and look at the research that's going on with our pets. In our Ask an Expert section, we have guests that will enthrall you with their area of knowledge. This is the Science Podcast. Hello, welcome to another Science Podcast episode. I hope everybody's happy and healthy out there. Wow, back to school for Chris and I. It's a little surreal teaching kids with masks on and being super careful with your physical distancing. Most teachers have taped out a little spot at the front of the classroom where we are 2 and a bit meters away from our students so we can take our masks off to teach. Just because it's a lot of work projecting your voice all day if it's being muffled by cloth. I can see why a lot of people in healthcare were complaining, and I see totally see it, about their voices being raw because you have to talk so much louder. And that's tough if you're a teacher because you basically talk all day long. So our school division is allowing the teachers to take their masks off if we can maintain 2 or more meters of physical distancing. And that's not possible for kids. So they are in our rows. They are learning. They've got masks on. There's a couple places usually in every class where kids can go to be kind of like away from other kids so they can take their masks off for a break. But it's definitely weird. It is very tough to recognize kids when all you're seeing is their eyes and not their whole face. Chris isn't going to be in the classroom this year. She's teaching the online portion of all of the grade 8 and grade 9. I think they're looking to hire another person to help her out. There's more kids in her division that are more parents in her division that have opted for online learning than mine. There's quite a demand for it. So they've had to scoop some teachers from regular teaching to instruct online. On the podcast this week in science news, it's all about saving the Earth. A really interesting and maybe slightly scary article about how much of the Earth needs to be protected to preserve biodiversity and help stave off climate change. In dog science, we're going to take a look at a really fun study that looks at pheromones that can calm down the households that have cats and dogs in them. I can't imagine, but I know there's a lot of families out there that have cats and dogs in the same household. In the Ask an Expert section of the podcast, we have Raven, the science maven, who is a science communicator extraordinaire. She also has an undergrad in molecular biology and had a whole bunch of really cool things happen while this podcast was being cut together. It's a great chat. We've got Woo or Wow back. We've got the mailbag this week. So let's get to it. Hey, Bunsen and Beaker, do you know what could happen if it's raining cats and dogs? You could step on a poodle. Okay. On with the show. Because there's no time like science time. This week in science news, we're going to take a look at a plan put together by conservational biologists from Washington, D.C. about how much of the Earth needs to be protected to save off destructive loss of biodiversity and also protect the Earth from climate change. So I don't know about you, but 2 or 3 months ago, 4 months ago, man, it feels like this year is like 12 years long, when everything was shut down, there were less people driving because people were trying their best to work from home. Now, working from home definitely benefited the privileged, people who had high-speed internet, computers, jobs that you could do from home. People who had to work in supermarkets and restaurants and other jobs either lost their job or still had to go in despite COVID-19. Now, the Earth did get a break from our carbon dioxide during the shutdown. There was, you know, satellite footage of China when China went through its great big shutdowns that showed smog reduction. The same thing happened in the big cities in the United States, and the same thing happened in Canada. And we're still seeing an echo effect of that, like there's less traffic. That could be because people are still working from home and there's still stay-at-home orders on the books in different cities. For the most part, the CO2 that humanity is releasing is back to nearly what it was pre-apocalypse, pre-big shutdown. Now, that was a good thing for the Earth to take a little break. In the long term, it's not going to help it with climate change. The conservational biologists in this story are looking at this big crisis our planet is facing. It's facing it because it's already happening. One is the dramatic loss of biodiversity all over the world, and the other is climate change. The average person was out in nature more than they've ever been before. If you were trapped in your house, but you can still walk in the park and physically distance yourself, a lot of people got a second look at nature, at the world around them that wasn't through a screen. On the podcast, we've spoken to numerous experts and science enthusiasts, and including naturalists, who have stood up for nature and also explained the looming crisis with climate change. We spoke to a glaciologist. We've spoke to climate change scientists. We've spoken to people who study different types of animals. Dr. Danny Rabiotti comes to mind, who studies the painted dogs in Africa. And there's definitely a loss of biodiversity all over the world. Definitely climate change is a thing. And there's one thing that is making it worse that ties them together, and it's human development of natural lands. Not only does when humans encroach on natural land, and we'll get to how little natural land is left, but as humans go into where there were no humans before and take away animals' natural habitat, you lose the plants that sequester carbon. So it's a double whammy. Not only are you taking away an ecosystem, you're taking away a carbon sink. The conservational biologists at Resolve, which is a nonprofit, came up with how much land needs to be set aside for animals to both help climate change and preserve a destructive loss of biodiversity. And the number they've got to is of the land that has very little or zero development, half of that land needs to be completely reserved for natural habitat. So whatever the earth has left, we absolutely have to keep half of that, or there'll be catastrophic losses of biodiversity and ramping up of climate change effects. The 50% that they're setting aside is being called the global safety net. So these biologists came up with kind of like a percentage that has to be set aside to achieve certain biological goals. So of existing protected land, so these are areas that are already protected by government, that covers about 15% of the undeveloped land left in the world. And then other kind of like slivers and pizza slices were added to do different types of goals. So the most threatened animals by extinction that aren't already protected, you would need to find an additional 2.3%. This land will help protect any animal that is currently under threat of extinction. 4.7% more land could be added in forests around the world. In fact, most in the northeastern part of the United States. So if that land was protected, meaning that you couldn't log it, you couldn't develop it, that would be a huge carbon sink to help protect the climate. An additional 6% was more to protect exceptional biodiversity, so about 6.3. Those are large mammals that need lots of space. Remember, the large mammals are the first thing to be affected by human encroachment. That's why things like elephants and big prey animals are going extinct at the rate they are, is they just need way more space. So the 6% could help protect like the jaguars in South America. Now, there's a lot of animals that migrate crazy distances. I actually talked about that in a Science News article, many podcast episodes ago. And a good example is the caribou. And that's just one animal that requires exceptional amount of land for its migratory patterns. And that would be an additional 16% more land needs to be protected. So this is land that's not already protected, but finding their migratory paths, that land to eliminate biodiversity loss needs to be protected. No human encroachment. Finally, they said that if you could carve out another 5%, that could be set aside for sequestering carbon in trees and grasslands. Currently, governments around the world are drafting plans to protect 30% of the entire world by 2030. So that means like 30% of the entire globe. One of the scary stats that this group has put out is that 75% of Earth's surface has been altered by our presence. And there are biomes on Earth. Biomes are like the geographical formations and the weather and the climate. So there's 14 biomes, terrestrial biomes on Earth. Terrestrial meaning land. So this is an ocean. 8 of those biomes have only 10% undeveloped wilderness left. That's it. Think of that. Only 10% of an entire biome, like desert or tropical rainforest, is left and not encroached on and developed by humans. This has led to an incredible acceleration of extinction. Some animals may be beyond our saving, even if we start to protect areas, and that's both sad and scary. So if the world is shooting for 30%, the conservational biologists are hoping they could get that up to 50%. This goes without saying that the undertaking to protect areas not developed by humans is going to start to step on the toes of industry and business. And some countries are better suited to protect areas than others. If you think about my country, Canada, so the Canadians that are listening, you know that Canada is sparsely populated, right? Like, aside from the huge cities and the really high population density areas of Ontario and Quebec, like by the United States border there, Toronto, Ottawa, like that whole area into Quebec, and the big cities in Western Canada, like the two in Alberta, Edmonton and Calgary, and then maybe say like Lower Mainland and British Columbia around Vancouver and Abbotsford, there's not a whole lot of huge development. In fact, you can drive through most of Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta, and it's just road and trees and grassland. So for us in Canada to start to protect these areas is going to say be way easier than more population dense places like in the United States or in Europe. And also, more affluent countries are better suited to protect areas than countries where the average person, if their choice is to burn down the rainforest and plant crops so their family doesn't starve, their first thing on their list of priorities may not be protecting biodiversity. It may be putting the food on the table. And the other thing that the biologists have also mentioned is that a lot of people in developed countries who've been financially affected by the coronavirus, that's something that is now further down their list. If you've lost your job and you're worried about where your next paycheck is going to come from to pay rent or to get your kids into college, you may not be as likely to donate or care so much about biodiversity and climate change issues. It's just way more existential than the immediate threat to your family. What can the average person do? Listen to what biologists are telling us. Conservational biology is just as real a science as any other science there is. If nature is important to you, speak up. If you've been in nature and you've enjoyed it, think about it going away. Donate to causes in your country that preserve it. It's kind of a scary prospect to me that my kids' kids in Canada may not be able to enjoy Canada the same way I have with Bunsen and Beaker. Something to think about. That's science news for this week. This week in pet science, we have a fun study from the University of Lincoln in the United Kingdom about keeping cats and dogs in your house happy. I can't imagine having cats and dogs in the same household. My father-in-law does. So you might have seen Doc, his little miniature schnauzer, in some of our pictures. And my father-in-law has also a couple cats too. And they all seem to get along pretty good. Bunsen goes over to the house occasionally because Bunsen and Doc are good buds. And Bunsen is curious about the cats, but he kind of leaves them alone. Chris made the mistake of bringing Beaker to my father-in-law's house, and it was a gong show because Beaker attacks Doc playfully, and Doc doesn't like to play, so that was bad. And then, of course, there's cats, and Beaker doesn't know what a cat is. And if a cat runs away, Beaker's prey drive goes into overdrive. So prey and play becomes chase the cats, and that was just a gong show. So anyways, on to this study. It's adorable. It's by Professor Daniel Mills and Miriam Pryor, and it explored or went over the effects of pheromone products on dog and cat interactions. And they were looking to see if there could be an improvement to cat and dog interactions positively. Like, by adding the pheromones to your house, did the dog and cat get along better? This paper is in the Journal of Frontiers in Veterinary Science. there are commercial products you can buy, and that's what they were testing. One is called FeelAway Friends, and the other is Adaptatil. And FeelAway Friends, and supposedly, and I'm laughing, but the study actually is really interesting. FeelAway Friends emits pheromones which calm cats. Adaptatil, I'm not sure why they didn't call it Adaptatil, but anyways, Adaptatil does the same thing for dogs. So how did the study determine if these products worked? Well, you have to try them out and then observe, like any good experiment would. It was about a month and a half, they looked at to see if there was a noticeable difference in undesirable reactions. So the team met and they're like, what are some undesirable interactions? And it's basically bringing Beaker to my father-in-law's house. Dog chasing cat, check. Cats hiding from dog, check. Cat and dog staring at each other, check. Dog barking at cat, check. So it sounds like we would need these products if they work. The pet owners were supposed to report over this month and a half long time frame about 10 specific undesirable pet interactions between the dogs and cats in their house. They were split into two groups. One used FeelAway Friends and the others used Adaptatil. And the pheromones were supplied in unlabeled packaging. So you didn't know which pheromone you were getting, and an independent staff member gave the pheromones to the person. So it was close to a double-blind study. One interesting thing that was noted going into this month and a half long procedure, was that the relationship between the cat and the dog was almost always on the behavior of the cat. If the cat seemed to be more comfortable with the dog, the interactions were a lot better. So it's like they were blaming the cat instead of the dog. I'm pretty sure it's 100% on Beaker when Beaker came over there. So what did they find? Well, users of Adaptatil observed a significant increase in desirable behaviors. They saw more friendly greetings, and they saw more time spent in the same room, and they saw more, I guess, less stare downs, some more friendly looks at each other. So it appears that the Adaptatil did have an overall improvement to the interactions between the cat and the dog. FeelAway Friends, the one that affects the cat, didn't seem to have much or any, perhaps even zero, impact on the dog-cat relationship, but the dog-cat relationship with the Adaptatil did. So that may be that the behavior of the dog is the determinant of the quality of life between the cat and the dog. So what was perceived at the start of the study, that it was all on the cat for being sketchy, it perhaps is all on the dog for being annoying. Because the Adaptatil is the pheromone that is supposedly supposed to calm down the dog. Now, they suggest that there's a whole bunch more study that needs to be done on this and look at the active ingredients in Adaptatil, the specific pheromones that might be released, because maybe you could put that in some kind of diffuser system, like specifically because it's a mixture of pheromones. It would be really interesting to see if it was something in there that kind of chilled the dog out. Or maybe there's something in there that chilled the cat out, but they thought it was for dogs. I just thought it was a really cute study. I'm laughing all the way through this. I apologize, but it's just talking to my wife about how much of a disaster it was bringing Beaker to a house with cats. I think I would, if it was a decent price, I'd be willing to try Adaptatil to see if it helped out between Beaker and the cats. If you're wondering, I'll try to put a link to Adaptatil and FeelAway Friends in the show notes. That's Pet Science for this week.
If you've been listening to the show and you like the content, consider signing up on our Patreon page as a patron. The podcast, unfortunately, isn't free to run, even though we really enjoy doing it. It's been a great addition to our lives to share more in-depth science news than our Twitter accounts and definitely Instagram can allow. Our Patreon page is patreon.com/BunsenBurner, and there are four tiers of support. If you head over there, you can see the different monetary amounts, but the lowest one is only $5 a month. That's not that bad. We do about four or five shows a month. Four shows, great education and entertainment for $5. Can't beat it. Plus, we send out perks. The other way the show makes money is through merchandise sales. We've worked with a cartoonist to deliver some amazingly adorable merchandise on our merchandise shop, and that's at www.bunsenburnerbmd.com. The links are in the show notes, and you can peruse the adorable merchandise. Thanks, guys. Now on to the interview. On the Science Podcast, in the Ask an Expert section, I am delighted to have Raven, the Science Maven, with me today. How are you doing today, Raven?
Hi, I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm so excited to talk to you about all the amazing stuff that you're up to. Where are you calling into the program from in the world?
I am from Buffalo, New York, which is all the way at the top of the U.S. near Canada.
Oh, so you're close to the border then. Buffalo is really, like, that's a...
We are like a border patrol.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, you could literally, you could probably walk across the border from places in Buffalo just about.
Yeah, there's Canadian flags hanging on the same poles as American flag poles here, so...
Ah, that's how it should be. Our country should be a lot closer together, I think.
Yeah.
And the other question I've been asking, because it's really topical, is how you and your family and people you know are doing with coronavirus. It's hit different places of the world kind of tough and kind of hard. Is everything going okay?
Well, I'm really fortunate to have not been negatively impacted by COVID at this point. Everybody around me is happy, healthy, safe, and well. And, you know, I'm just trying to continue being happy, healthy, safe, and well in my own way.
That's a great answer. Yeah, not everybody's had a good go, and some people have had to put themselves in harm's way, especially like our nurses and doctors and the frontline people like grocery clerks.
Right.
So that's good to hear. I'm glad people will be happy for that. Raven, could you tell everybody a little bit about what your education and your journey in science up to this point has been? That's another thing that people are really interested about our guests is like, where were you with your scientific journey? Where are you and what your training is?
Yeah. So, so I like to call myself a lifelong scientist, mainly because I can't imagine a time in my life where I did not have this curiosity and joy for engaging with science. And so I actually pursued science throughout childhood. I went to college, studied, I had different majors as many college students did. I studied environmental science, environmental law and policy, science education and biology, genetics. And I ended up getting 2 degrees in cell and molecular biology, a bachelor's and a master's degree.
Oh, wow.
I'm currently pursuing a PhD in science education. I should be finished either at the end of this year or early next year.
Are you with your PhD? Are you doing research with science education? Like, I'm kind of curious how that works.
Yeah. So my focus is actually understanding, it's really a science communication study that I'm conducting.
Oh, cool.
Research, and I'm looking at how the media representation of scientists impact how adults who have either STEM careers or non-STEM careers identify with science. And some of the research data that I'm getting is really showing that people are inspired when they have representation on TV that they can relate to. And that kind of can be a great determining factor in whether those people pursue a STEM career or not.
Well, that's very powerful. I'm kind of stumbling here to kind of get to what I'm trying to say, but I'd imagine as that data comes in, it makes you inspired with where you are as a science communicator, but also kind of disappointed because the representation just isn't there yet for all different peoples and different peoples of color.
Right. Yeah. You know, I largely conducted the study and initiated the research because I saw the need, and it's really grounded in my own experiences, being the only one and not seeing anybody else, you know, and that's in many regards, in regards of my gender, my ethnic identity, my personality. You know, I'm a very outgoing, fun, vibrant person. And, you know, that's not often represented in STEM, we do get some really special characters that we have on TV. But I think that it's time for us to change the narrative and start telling different stories of people who have these jobs.
I love it. Yeah. The stereotypical view when I was growing up of a scientist, or, you know, there were no science communicators outside of probably Carl Sagan, it was just a white guy in a lab coat who was like, like stuffy and like monotone and super nerdy. Right. So that's not what scientists are. Or at least we need to change the perception that that's not what scientists are. So I love that study that you're doing. That's so cool.
Thank you.
So you said when you were younger, you were always curious about science. Was it a slow burn to get to where you are today? Like you, as far back as you can remember, you've always liked all parts of science? Or was there like an aha moment that you can remember where, you know, the fire was lit?
So I had ADHD when I was a child. I was diagnosed. I was very hyper. I was curious about many things, and I was not only curious, but I was diving into many things and getting my hands dirty, mixing things around the house. I was just trying to figure out what happens when you mix nail polish with sugar and then lotion and rub it on your body, you know, like that kind of stuff. And my mother saw that curiosity and really did hard work in harnessing that and making it a productive thing for me. So she put me in like STEM camps, and she used what little money she had to get me like at-home science kits. And eventually I earned a scholarship to go to space camp.
Good for you.
Thanks. And I really enjoyed space camp.
That's so cool.
I know. It's definitely something I look back on that was incredibly impactful, because it was really the first time that I had been around a lot of other kids who really liked science. Obviously, we all like science because we were there, but they were from all over the world, like as far as Australia and China. And just to go to space camp in Huntsville, Alabama. And so we all got to know each other. We did astronaut training. Of course, I wasn't taking things seriously because I was a goofy child. And we were doing mock space missions, like mock space launching, shuttle launching. And we could have different roles in the launch. So at one point you could be taking on the role of a mission control officer or doing the countdown for the launch, or you could be the pilot for the shuttle, or you could be a payload specialist, like focused on doing, I don't know, experiments, etc. And so I got in trouble because I got onto the intercom system and told everyone that I had saved 15% on my car insurance by switching to Michael.
So you were the comedian, the Mark Watney of the crew, hey?
I don't know who that is, but
he's the Matt Damon character from The Martian, the guy that gets stranded with. Yeah. He's got the really dry humor and the really he doesn't take things seriously in life or death situations. So
yes, yeah. That was me. I did see that movie. I'm not really great with remembering names.
It's okay.
But like that's always kind of been my mood. Like I'm here for the science, but I'm also going to be myself. I also found out I was afraid of heights at space camp. So a career as an astronaut certainly went out the window for me. But luckily, they did a great job in teaching kids that there's so many careers that contribute to the space field. And, you know, if we're planning a mission to Mars, we have to consult with geologists who can understand the terrain. You know, obviously rocket scientists to help build the shuttle and understand how it flies, chemists to formulate the fuel for the rockets, and all of these careers come into play. So even though I probably wasn't going to be doing space travel, I guess that point forward, I really gave me the license to just go out and explore everything else that there was.
That's awesome. What a cool segue into my next question. So from space camp and then to where you are today, your undergrad or master's, was that in molecular biology?
Yes.
So, I mean, you're right. When you're an undergrad, sometimes you ping pong ball around until you find something that really connects with you. What was it about molecular biology that really grabbed you?
So I'm bilingual. I speak English and Spanish.
Oh, cool.
And so for a fraction of my schooling, I was actually in Spanish immersion school. Which essentially is when you don't speak English during your school day. And so I was kind of brought up with understanding education in two languages. So when I got to college, I took genetics and I quickly realized that our own bodies have a language. Our cells speak a language in order to generate our organismal functions, and that's genetics. The genetic code is a language that we can study and learn how to interpret it to come away with different scientific developments and understand life as a whole. It's a universal language that we all speak that most of us aren't even aware of. So I was fascinated with that, and I really wanted to kind of pursue understanding genetics and the products of gene expression as a career.
Well, that's what a cool way to explain that the body has a language, and it's from your experience being bilingual. I wish I was bilingual. I live in a country where we have two national languages. My wife and my sons are bilingual, and they can speak French to each other, and I have no idea what they're saying.
Oh,
I am
no.
just useless at it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all right. I speak chemistry, so that's another language too. So there you go.
It's a special language.
It's a special language. Yeah.
It's a language that makes me cry, to be honest.
it's not for everybody. I couldn't spell. That's why I really like biology, but I had a terrible time spelling. So that's what killed me all the time. I would constantly spell things wrong on, you know, like big tests and labeling diagrams. And they're like, hey, you can't spell cat with a K. I'm like, okay, no, not that bad. Not that bad. But yeah, that's awesome.
That's hilarious.
What you're doing now is kind of interesting. You've got somewhat of a part-time gig as a science communicator. You've got a show on the go called Nerdy Jobs, plus some other things that you do. Like some speaking things that you do. Could you talk to us about that?
Yeah. So I'm, there's so many things going on. I don't even know where to start.
Pick your favorite.
So my favorite,
are they all your favorites?
They're all my favorites. I guess one of my biggest projects that I've completed this year is the release of my music album called The Protocol. And that was my special project that I put out there, and it's a 5-track project that's really packed with STEM-themed music that has really fun STEM lyrical wordplay and messages of empowerment for people in STEM to be their unapologetic selves. And there's different genres in there. There's rap, pop, like a little spoken word in there. And I released it and it did really well. I sold 2,000 copies of my album.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
I wasn't expecting that, but people really loved it. And I think the most rewarding thing about releasing the album was hearing people say that they listen to my music when they work in the lab, and that my music motivates them to kind of keep going and just keep a smile on their face, you know, even when their experiment gets messed up, or maybe their big project didn't go as they expected, and maybe maybe they don't even have a friend to kind of have fun with in the lab. I've heard all of these stories related to my music. So I'm really proud of that. And you mentioned Nerdy Jobs. Nerdy Jobs is my latest baby that I am taking care of as far as my SciComm projects go. And Nerdy Jobs is kind of like a play on the show Dirty Jobs. and I guess that's hopefully obvious through the title, but it's a comedy and explorational series where I go around performing seldomly seen, odd, fascinating, or even maybe dirty occupational duties with STEM professionals. And I'll showcase a diversity of scientists and the reality of their work, including the successes, the failures, and the nitty and the gritty of what they do. And it's going to be a really fun show. I'm looking forward to just being my unapologetic self times 10 because I'll have a budget. I'll have a budget to really show you guys who I am and in the most entertaining way as possible. And I just can't wait to carve out this really special and fun space in TV for science.
That's amazing. Now, is some of it hush hush, or can you give us more details? Like it's in it sounds like it's in development. Is that, am I on the right track?
Yeah, it's in development. I'm currently in talks with getting the show on television.
Congratulations. That's so cool.
Thanks. I just can't like tell where it's going to be, and
yeah,
it's also not confirmed yet. So, but at the very least it will be on the internet regardless. It's going to exist. Awesome.
Well, as soon as you know more information, keep Bunsen and Beaker's account in mind, cause we'll help get the word out when it becomes a thing.
Thanks, Bunsen and Beaker. I appreciate it. Yay.
So the videos that you shot, like kind of the music videos and your music, is that who you are? Is that why you get so much joy from it? Is that you're just, that's yourself. That's you. That's, you don't have to hide who you are.
That's me 100%. Like, and I feel like with everything that I do, as I'm learning how to translate who I am onto the camera and in front of the camera, I feel like every project that I do is more and more looking like who I am. So I'm really hoping that Nerdy Jobs is like a 100,000,000% Raven and more, you know, I'm really excited about it.
That's great. It's inspiring. Just listen to you talk with such passion. I love it.
Thanks.
I want to say that a couple of your songs remind me of like a more specific Weird Al Yankovic type thing, the way that you take and play with words. Mm-hmm. I grew up listening to Weird Al Yankovic. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's like this Canadian.
Yeah, I know Weird Al. Yeah. He's inspiring.
Yeah, you know, Weird Al. Yeah, yeah. So I almost loved his versions of the songs more than the actual versions of the songs. And sometimes I only knew his version of the song before I listened to the real version. So I wonder if some folks are going to be that way with your music. They'd be like, wait, oh, that's how it's supposed to go, but Raven's was this way.
Yeah, I think that's how people felt when I put out Wipe It Down.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, if you don't know the music, they know yours because it was the first time you heard it. That's right. Great. One of the questions we ask kind of in the middle of the interview is for a pet story. Do you have a pet story you could share with us? We always ask guests because it kind of brings home the fact that everybody who loves science probably also loves pets as well.
Oh yeah.
Do you have one you could share with us?
Okay. So here's my pet story. So my beloved cat, he was Baby Frog. He was the best cat. Okay. I don't care what anybody else says. Bunsen and Beaker, you guys don't have anything to worry about. Because you're dogs, but I had the best. And his name was Baby Frog. And again, I not only am bad at remembering names, I'm bad at naming animals. So I like frogs a lot, and I couldn't keep a frog, so I named my cat Frog. Anyways, so me and baby Frog were casually just sitting around in our house. At the time, I lived by myself, and I am not very fond of large insects. Like, if it's bigger than a penny or a dime, honestly, if it's bigger than if it's bigger than my nail, I'm not going to mess with it. But baby Frog would take care of it. So quite often, he would hold up my cat to any bug, and he would just like paw it and then eat it. So there was this one day where I was in the bathroom, and I turned to look towards the window, and I see a green slither of something on the windowsill. And I have terrible vision, so I'm finding my glasses. I put my glasses on, and I look back at the windowsill, only to see that there is a praying mantis.
Oh.
I know, in my bathroom. And I lived by myself at the time. So, you know, it's in my bathroom. It's not going to just leave the bathroom. You know, like, it's not just going to disappear. If I don't do anything about the praying mantis, it's just going to still be in the bathroom. Unless baby Frog took care of it. So I go to get my cat, baby Frog, and he is not just an ordinary cat. He was a 23-pound cat. Okay?
Oh, big guy.
Big guy. Big, hefty dude. and so, trust me, if he's swatting at a bug, the bug's not going to stand a chance. I wasn't sure about the praying mantis, though, because that's a big, you know, that's also a hefty bug. So I get baby Frog, and I hold him up to the praying mantis, thinking he's got this, right? He's always had my back. He's not going to miss this chance to get this bug. And guess what happened? Baby Frog screams at the bug and runs away completely. He, like,
oh no,
abandoned me. He was afraid of the bug. He was just as afraid of the bug as I was. So he ran out the room screaming. I ran out the room screaming. And we didn't go back into the bathroom for another 2 days. I don't know. I don't know where the bug went, but it wasn't there. I don't know where it went. But yeah, that's the story of the one time that my cat and I were both afraid of a bug.
I love it. He had your back until you really needed him to get rid of the mantis.
I know. I don't blame him, though. It was, you know, I feel like that level of debugging, I guess, stem pun there. really, you have to train for that. I don't know. You can't just go from beating up quarter-sized bugs to going to praying mantises. Like, I don't blame him.
Yeah, they're pretty fierce. I've trained in martial arts for about half my life in kung fu, and our style of kung fu specializes in praying mantis. So the praying mantises are no joke. They're pretty fierce predators in the bug kingdom.
They're no joke. I actually recorded this, so if I ever find the video of us both running from this bug, I'll have to send it your way.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for sharing your story about your cat, Baby Frog. I love that you named it Baby Frog.
And he's a 23-pound cat, I know.
Yeah. Is it something that people who don't really like cats or pets would be like, give you a look when you say your cat's name is Baby Frog? Whereas everybody else is like, no, we get it. Yeah, that's just Baby Frog.
I mean, I never noticed. I'm sure I got some weird looks, but I just loved my cat so much that I didn't even like think that other people would even think anything of his name.
Ooh. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Don't worry about them. Well, we get that sometimes with Bunsen and Beaker.
Yeah.
Especially now that we've got the little one whose name is Beaker, is they do a little bit of a double take. They're like, what?
Right.
And then a lot of people think we named them after the Muppets, which is true. But it's also after like adorable lab equipment too. So yeah. The other thing we ask our guests for as well is something called the super fact. And the super fact is something that you know that when you tell people, it kind of like blows their mind a bit, kind of like how Baby Frog's mind was blown by the praying mantis. Do you have a super fact you could share with us?
Super fact. Well, lately, my super fact has kind of been, there's been a lot of conversations about race and ethnicity and et cetera. And I have a lot of fun telling people like the actual molecular biology behind skin color. And a lot of people are under the impression that there's only one skin pigment that's responsible for determining, you know, all of the different colors that we find in our bodies. And that's actually not true. So everybody kind of knows about melanin. And melanin is kind of like an umbrella term for the different pigments that contribute to our various spectrums of skin color. But melanin is actually divided into three types of melanins. There's eumelanin, which makes like brown to black pigments. There is pheomelanin, which makes red to yellow pigments. And then neuromelanin is a melanin that we actually don't know. We as scientists, we're still trying to figure out what it actually does, but we know it's made in the brain and might play a role in brain disorders. So, yeah, those are my fun facts. Definitely look into those if you're listening. Really interesting stuff.
That's crazy. I had no idea. So is there a fourth melanin for people like me who are Polish? Because we're kind of pale blue. We're like Smurfs. What color is that? What color are the Smurfy pale blue people?
I don't know about pale blue people, but I know that
like we're not full on blue man group blue. Like not that blue, but just like a shade of like nice little like egg like baby blue. Just see like, oh, that's not quite, you know, it's a little. Because we never see the sun, right? I don't know. I'm just kidding.
Well, people who are dark skinned, like me, I'm the color of like a Hershey's kiss. I'm really dark brown, and so people like me, we have really high concentrations of eumelanin, which is what is responsible for making the brown to black pigments. And then as you go up lighter on the skin color spectrum, let's say to maybe like a Polish person who straight from Poland, they most likely aren't going to be the color of a Hershey kiss, more like the color of, I don't know, a peach, I guess, a really light peach. They're going to have
kind of a blue.
Yeah. A blueberry peach. They're going to have lesser eumelanin and likely some higher concentrations of pheomelanin.
That's so cool.
It is really neat. And then obviously the absence of melanins is what we call albinism. Albino people have.
That has something also to do with like as people have less of that eumelanin, they're more susceptible to the sun and need more like UV protection. Am I on the right track or is that wrong?
No, it's kind of like a catch-22. So yeah, people who have less eumelanin have been shown to be more susceptible to UV damage from sun rays, but also people who have high concentrations of melanin in their skin also really effectively block UV rays, but also to the point where it kind of interferes with our vitamin D. So vitamin D, it gets synthesized basically in our bodies with help from sun rays. If you have high concentrations of melanin blocking the sun rays, then it also might affect your vitamin D. So it's kind of a catch-22. It's like, you know, if you don't have enough melanin, you might get sunburnt. But if you have a lot of melanin, you might need to kind of take extra care to make sure you're having enough vitamin D intake.
Yeah, that's okay. So I was on the right track because, like historically, the further north that you went, you like humans evolved fairer skin. So the less sunlight would allow them to produce more vitamin D. So it was kind of like a adaptation based on where you are in relative to the equator.
Mm-hmm.
We have sunny winters in Canada, right? Like our winters are really, really long where we live in Canada. And I know some folks do take vitamin D supplements just because they're inside all the time and there's not a lot of, they're not out in the sun very often.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It is.
Interesting.
Nina Jablonski she's an anthropologist who's really well known for her research on the evolution of skin color in humans. So, and she has like a couple of TED Talks out. So definitely look into Nina Jablonski.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Well, you know what? This super fact has turned into a super conversation. So I'm so happy you brought that up, Raven. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for asking.
Before we get to the end of the last question of the interview, I was wondering if you could talk to us about, you sometimes do speaking engagements as well. Where have you done speaking engagements before?
Well, I have really spoken with a lot of small groups, young groups of students. And I'm also giving a TEDx talk next month. Well, I'm filming it next month and we're releasing it in September because of COVID. We can't give a live performance, not a performance, talk. Yeah. So, I've done a little bit of,
is the TEDx talk really hush hush? Can I ask you a follow-up question there?
Yeah, you can ask.
How does that happen? Who is TED Talk and how do they get a hold of you to do a TED Talk? Like, this is the first I've had other guests who have given TED Talks before. And I'm like, cool. And then the more I think about it is like, who is TED Talk? Who, how, like, it's all, I watch the videos all the time and I show them to my students. I'm like, they're like, kids are like, ooh, TED Talk. I'm like, yeah, they're going to be amazing because they're TED Talk. How did that happen for you?
So I guess people really don't know this, but you can actually apply to give a TEDx talk. And
oh, cool.
Yeah, they've got a really great website. And you could just Google TEDx and you can filter out by location and they will show you the themes for the current season. That are happening near you or wherever you want to search for. And they link to websites. And if it's at the correct time of the year, they will most likely have a call for speakers on their TEDx website. And each TEDx event should have their own website where you can submit your materials and be considered. So I highly advise that if anybody's interested in getting their ideas out and spreading their ideas, to go and investigate, like, where would be a good fit to speak.
Oh, and congratulations that they selected you. That's got such an honor.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm super excited. It's really intimidating because just like you.
I can't imagine. I'd be just like sweating bullets the whole time.
I know. I'm really not bad with public speaking. I honestly wish that it weren't. That it wasn't a recorded event. I mean, as in, I would rather do it live in front of a live audience.
Oh.
But this sitting in front of a camera and like doing this really important talk that I only get to do one time is just for some reason really intimidating. But it's going to be perfectly fine.
Yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait to see it. That's so cool. I love it.
Thank you.
The last question, we've been giving guests a little bit of leeway to shape themselves, and I've truly enjoyed listening to what people have had to say. So one of the things you brought up is you have a passion or you have an interest in the science communication and the science and policy and just having people understand about how important climate change is. Could you speak to us about that?
Yeah, it's, you know, this is something that I am really working on learning how to communicate because I feel that there are a lot of communicators in STEM who are really trying to shake people awake and get them to understand the pressing issue of climate change. And for some reason, it's not quite registering with people. And so I've been kind of carefully dissecting how to begin these important conversations. You know, there's no easy answer, because it's, we see what's happening now with the pandemic, and even as things are occurring in real time, that are affecting society, it's affecting society as we know it. There's still so many roadblocks to people doing the right thing and following the rules, and people, you know, who really just aren't doing a great job taking care of each other, you know, by wearing their mask and socially distancing themselves. And, you know, so I am trying to work with other science communicators to think about ways that we can really generate a genuine interest in the public for wanting to be better citizens of the earth. And so that's been on my mind a lot. And I guess I would like for anybody to who's listening to this podcast to kind of think of ways that they can help spread the message about climate change and also be a play a role in helping us slow down climate change and hopefully eliminate it as a whole, if that's possible. But it's been in my mind a lot. I don't know. What have you had any thoughts about climate change recently in light of the pandemic?
Raven, I could talk to you for hours about climate change. It's such a thing, hey. The first guest from season two was Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. She's a Canadian climatologist. And so we talked about that. And man, the minefield that science communicators and people like herself, who has a PhD in climate science, they just get hammered every day on social media. It's unbelievable. It's quite frustrating from my perspective, because I see them using science that's used everywhere else, and they just get the vitriol that gets drug up to the top just because people disagree with taking that on is very noble. And I just have a lot of respect for people that do that.
Yeah, same.
Our province, I've said this before on the podcast, and it's definitely like you used the word catch-22 before. Our province that I live in Canada is in a catch-22 right now. Alberta is the oil and gas producing province of Canada. Like we, for the last 20 years, we've been the economic engine that has driven Canada's growth. Like it's made us part of the G7. I don't know if anybody follows the G7, but yeah. Canada's like population wise, this tiny country, like we have hardly any people, but our economy has been so huge because of oil and gas. And Alberta, where we live, has a giant sector of natural gas and oil, and also the oil sands, which are in Fort McMurray, which is fairly environmentally difficult and not great to get out of the ground. So we are always in this catch-22, because I teach high school of we have to promote climate change because it's real. The science is there, but also like 20% of the kids I teach have a parent that work in natural or oil and gas, right? So it's definitely a tightrope that a lot of people have to walk, because there's the economy, but also the science that shows. Yeah, I'm just rambling now, but like, yeah, it's a big deal, isn't it?
yeah, absolutely. There's just so much to take in. But I mean, we just can't afford to wait for people to understand.
No. Whenever I get down, I always go back and I listen to Dr. Catherine Hayhoe is great at explaining some things. And the main thing that she says that changes people's minds is talking about it. So even if grouchy people get grouchy about it, just our conversation right now, Raven, that's what she says is the biggest thing, is just talking about it and talking about it with your friends and family. Because if you talk about it, it's always in the back of people's minds.
Right. That's such a good point.
Yeah. People are, friends and family are more likely to change their viewpoint coming from you because they know you, as opposed to, you know, some scientist on Twitter. I'm so glad that you said that that was a passion of yours. That brings us to the end of our chat today, Raven. Thanks so much for talking to us on the Science Podcast. Where can people find you on social media?
You all can find me at Raven the Science Maven on YouTube and Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. And where else? I'm on TikTok. I'm at Science Maven and www.scimaven.com. And hopefully coming to a screen near you on somebody's major network. But we'll see. Circle back with me in a couple weeks.
As always, for the guests that are listening, you are all of those links that Raven's talking about, they'll be in the show notes. So you're one click away from all of those different platforms. And if Raven has figured out TikTok, I have tons of respect for her because I can't figure that one out. Bunsen has a TikTok account and it's just like, I can't get it. And I love the content that people produce because it's so good, but it's just, it takes a different way of thinking, I think.
Oh yeah. You definitely have to stretch your brain. It honestly took me a couple weeks to figure it out. But once I got going, I got it. I think you can get it too. You're super smart. I think you can do this for sure. Give it a couple weeks.
I'll try. Yeah.
But you don't have to. No pressure.
No. Bunsen has an account. I made one. Like TikTok was really, this is pre-COVID. No, I've actually talked to another biologist named Jada Elcock about this because she does these fun animal science things on TikTok. Because I teach high school kids, the girls were big into doing like these dances. Like that was big on TikTok or something. Maybe it still is. I don't know. So when they would get their work done, they'd be like, hey, can we go use the last 5 minutes to practice our TikTok dance? And I'm like, oh my goodness. Okay, fine. Cause you got all your work done. So I made Bunsen a TikTok account. And just because people migrated from his huge Twitter account, I had more followers than all of these high school girls following TikTok Bunsen. And they were a little chapped at me. They were a little salty because Bunsen got so many followers so quickly, but I was just like reposting Twitter videos. Like I was doing nothing. I had no creativity. Like some of the creativity stuff on there is pretty amazing. So I'll have to check your stuff out, Raven.
Okay. Yeah. Sounds good. Thanks so much.
All right. Well, this has been a really fun chat. I'm so excited to see what's coming in the future for you. And yeah, we'll circle back around. Probably when this podcast comes out, I'll be able to update everybody too, because I bank interviews.
Yay. Thanks so much for having me. This was really fun.
Thanks, Raven. Yeah, this has been really good too. All right, you take care of yourself and be safe.
Thanks, you too.
Hey, everybody. I just want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Genius Lab Gear. Genius Lab Gear is giving everybody 10% off everything at their store if you use the code BUNSEN10. That's BUNSEN10. Genius Lab Gear has a ton of cool stuff. We love that they sent Bunsen a bandana that says PhD Emotional Support Dog. It's so cute. Also, they have these little wallet-sized stencils for doing organic molecules. And if you're not a scientist or a science teacher, there's gear at the site that you would like as well, including Science is for Everyone stickers and a whole bunch of other stuff. Check them out. That's at geniuslabgear.com. It's time for Woo or Wow on the Science Podcast, and my guest host is Graham Walton from Lindsay Thurber. How are you doing today, Graham?
I'm doing awesome. How are you?
I'm good. Are you excited with startup, or do you have a little bit of uncertainty? What's going on?
I was cautiously optimistic, and now I'm more optimistic than I am cautious, so I don't know.
Oh, that's good. That's good. I'm pessimistically optimistic right now. I'm optimistic that it's way better to have kids in class teaching, but I'm pessimistic that we won't make it till October.
And I'm just not thinking about it, so oh well.
So, Graham, what do you teach? You've been on the podcast before as a guest host. What do you teach at Thurber?
I teach general science, but specialize in chemistry.
Right. He's one of my chemistry comrades. We got lots of chemistry comrades now.
We got tons. We just added technically a new one this year, actually.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
But we made him, not me. I made him teach physics.
Yeah. So.
All right. So there were two categories because I'm just for people listening at home, I did two of these back to back. And the one was snapped up. So you get molecular biology.
Oh, yes. That's what I'm talking about.
So again, I'll read three statements. Two of them are fake. They're woo. One of them is true. It's a wow. You have to find the true statement, and it's on molecular biology. That's got some chemistry in it.
It does, yes. I'm, again, cautiously optimistic.
There we go. That's the word.
Yeah.
It's the buzzword, like cohort.
Yeah.
You have a cohort of 2,000 kids.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Statement one, the DNA we share with chimpanzees is about 50% the same.
Woo.
Think that one's woo right off the top?
Yeah, I think that's woo.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, remember, you have to find the wow statement.
Though. I know. So okay. It doesn't really help me.
Okay, statement two. The closest invertebrate to us is the golden star tourniquet, also known as a sea scalp.
I cannot imagine that's true, but bring on the third one.
Third statement. DNA once made is nearly indestructible. Do you need a recap or you think you're good to go?
Yeah, just quickly all three again.
Statement one, the DNA we share with chimpanzees is about 50% the same. Statement two, the closest invertebrate to us is the golden star tourniquet, also known as a sea scalp. And statement three, DNA once made is nearly indestructible.
I want this so bad. So I'm going to choose the third one for a while. The DNA is almost indestructible.
Almost indestructible?
Yeah.
Okay. So you turned that first one down pretty fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're right. That one's definitely a woo.
Yeah.
That one's definitely a woo. It's actually in the high 90s, 98.7% we share with chimpanzees.
I was thinking it was up there.
there's actually very little under 50% of things that are alive, like even bananas. We have 41% the same DNA as bananas.
Oh, it's like fungi, maybe the one of the only things that we're not 50%.
I think fungi is actually higher than bananas.
Okay.
Like I think there were some molecular biologists who looked at things like humans, and if there were no humans, perhaps on other planets there could be sentient fungus. Because it has, I don't know. Who knows? That'd be pretty messed up.
I would love to see that.
Okay, so we're down to two left. You thought the last one was true?
Yeah.
Okay, which one do you want to hear first? Do you want to hear the tourniquet one or do you want to hear the indestructible one?
I want to hear the tourniquet one.
Okay. The closest invertebrate to us is the golden star tourniquet.
Ah, no.
It's true. It is definitely the closest invertebrate to us. Way closer in DNA than even like a spider or a bee or anything that you'd think.
Mm.
Yeah, the tourniquets.
That's tough.
I knew that one from taking the kids to Banfield.
Oh, that's cheating then.
Yeah, because one of the people there, she was mental for tourniquets. Because, you know, if you're listening to this and you're like a marine biologist, you usually probably have an animal that you're just crazy in love with.
Yes.
And she was just all about the tourniquets.
Yeah.
And she was yelling at kids like, you're more in common with the tourniquet than a bee. And the kids are like, who is this lady? It's algebra. Algebra, if you're listening, we love you. It's not true. DNA is not indestructible.
But I know that it's not indestructible because it can ionize and it can also interact with other chemicals. But you would assume it to be relatively stable because it's the instructions to make life, right? It's got to be at least a little bit chemically stable.
It's chemically stable, but easy to change because our body has a built-in checking system.
Oh, I guess that's true.
Right? There's actually a lot of mistakes that happen with DNA.
You have to correct errors whenever they're duplicated.
That's right. Errors through duplication, errors through mutations, UV light, you know, just random copying errors.
Yeah.
Yep. Lots of errors actually happen. DNA is easily changed. It is stable, but many chemicals are stable.
Yeah. Okay. That's what you get when you get an organic chemist talking about this kind of stuff. Whoops.
It's all good, Graham. All right. Thanks.
No problem.
Okay. I've opened the mailbag and it's time for Mailbag with me, Adam. So we got quite a few questions. I just need to address something right now. If I sound a bit different and my S's are a bit slurred, it's because I have Invisalign.
Yay, Invisalign!
Woohoo! Straight teeth.
So you're going to have to deal with a little bit of annoying S gross sounds because the air cannot pass through my teeth. Because Invisalign is just like having plastic film around all your teeth. Anyway, let's get into the questions. First question is, has Beaker shown any indications of enjoying cold weather like Bunsen, or is she more like Mommy Fave and prefers milder weather? And that is from Michelle A.
So, I think we haven't had cold enough weather to do a temperature check on that question. We might have to come revisit it. We've only had a couple of days where it's been chilly with a little bit of wind, and she seems just as willing to go outside and play. I think the interesting thing is that she does better in the hot weather than Bunsen does. Yeah. Bunsen just goes and lays in the shade. He says, I'm out after a long walk, whereas she is ready to go.
There's frost on the grass this morning.
I'm glad I brought my tomatoes in, which they're a fail. I don't know. I can't even.
Grew four tomatoes.
Four tomatoes. Woohoo! Yay, me. But yeah, so time will tell about the temperature. It was cold, but now it's a high of 26 today. So it was smoking hot for September.
Maybe we could put the tomatoes in like a glass cage outside and cook them. That it was pretty hot today. Like Mom said, it was smoking hot for September. Like it's never been, at least in a while, this hot in September.
Yes.
It's like mid-August heat right now. Kinda.
Yeah, Beaker.
What was that?
Okay, my turn. So this question is coming from Mandy. What is the energy difference between the dogs at the same age? I'm really curious at which age Bunsen decided to chill. I've always had Goldens in my experience, and it takes about 2.25-ish years for them to have really good manners and not be 90 miles per hour. Well, Bunsen and Beaker, you have to keep in mind that they're both different dog breeds and that they're both different. It's a boy and a girl, you know? So, yeah. But at the same time, Bunsen, when he was Beaker's age, wasn't as energetic. And that's because he's a bit of a lazy bones, you know? He likes to lay down after a walk. But Beaker's more like, yeah, let's keep going. It was a good warm-up. But yes, Bunsen was a lot more chill. He wasn't as bitey, but here's the contrary to that. He bit a lot harder as a puppy. But Beaker bites like not as hard because I think she knows that we're playing and not actually biting. Like Bunsen knows that now, but it's good not to have them bite.
Yeah, when Bunsen was a puppy, when he bit you, it hurt so bad.
Oh, it hurt so bad. It felt like a needle, but like four of them. But anyway, that's been my question. All right, this next question is coming in from Bridget Augustine. What aged students does Dad Guy teach, and does he use Bunsen and Beaker videos / pictures as learning aids?
So I teach high school kids, mostly grade 11 and 12. So they're, you know, between 15 and 18 years old. I'm the science department head for my school, so I do a little less teaching than the average teacher because I have administrative stuff on my job docket, I guess. Do I use pictures of them in videos? Absolutely. I try not to spam the kids too much with Bunsen and Beaker. So every day at the start of class, I might, if there's one a really cute picture or video, we might start class with that. And occasionally I'll work them into physics problems or chemistry problems. But also, I know the kids just don't want me to always talk about Bunsen and Beaker. Like they like other goofy problems. Like, I don't know, when Game of Thrones was big, I would have those characters in different energetics problems. Like Daenerys Targaryen has a dragon breathing fire. How many kilojoules does it breathe? Blah, 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 blah. So they are a big part of how I teach. And the kids love it when they come in during exam break. And because of when we shut down for online learning, nobody got to meet Beaker as a puppy, so everybody's super excited for when that happens. That's a great question.
All right, thank you guys so much for sending in all of your questions, and I had a blast, you know, answering them. Mom is outside taking Beaker out, I don't, because she was a bit rowdy. But yeah, it's been fun answering your questions, and I hope to see you on the next episode of the podcast where I might be doing mailbag or story time or something wacky. Anyway, that's been me, Adam. Bye.
That's the end of this week's podcast episode. Thanks for coming back week after week to listen to our crazy show. Also, special thanks to Raven the Science Maven, who right before this show was awarded a couple cool accolades. She's on the list of Fortune's 40 under 40. So people under 40 years old, there's 40 of them. She's on that list for science communication. And she was verified by Twitter. Very cool. Also, special thanks to our top tier patrons who make the show possible. We give them a shout out at the end of the show. Take it away, Chris.
Catherine Lynch, Judith Morton, Mary Coos, Marianne McNally, Daniel Fry, Shelby Leggett, Karen Beth St. George, Andrea Persons, Bianca Hyde, Brooke Lavallo, Kathy Zerker, Liz Button, and Ben Rathert.
Let's end with the dog's motto: for science, empathy, and cuteness.